Hello everyone, and welcome to Your Death Sentence. It's been a while since I've used that intro, actually. Today I am joined by a very special guest, Jesse Cohn, the author of The Book of Webs. Jesse, how's it going?
It's going pretty good, Eden. Nice to be with you here.
Nice to have you. Wait, are you the author of The Book of Webs, or has The Book of Webs sort of manifested for you? How does that work?
I consider myself the non-fictional human representative at this point.
Aspect.
So, yeah, like the part that has to exist.
That's an onerous task.
Yeah, it sucks. It really sucks.
For those of you who missed the episode that we did on The Book of Webs, what's the adjective I'm looking for here? Beguiling, confounding, so one of those adjectives. I think it's one of the most confounding books we've read for this show. And then during the episode, I posed like a few questions, I guess, to whoever manifested the book. And Jesse was kind enough to write into me as the existing representative of The Book of Webs. And to shed a bit of light on it. And then we started talking over email for the last few months, which have been crazy for me. And I understand for you as well, right, in your personal life?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we really wanted to record something together to talk about, I don't know how you would call it, like lesser known weird fiction. I think it's interesting that a genre or subgenre that purports to be about originality has such consensus around it. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, definitely. It seems like once you start talking in a specific niche that I guess we're in, it's like there's like, it seems like there's like 10 authors that everyone reads.
Yeah.
That are like awesome. It's great stuff. But as someone who's written a book and is not one of those 10 authors, I'm like, well, what else is there?
Yeah. I think it's super interesting. Like the closer you also gravitate to the well-defined new weird, the more that list becomes well-defined in turn, right? And there are like several voices, again, like you said, of which I am a big fan, right?
Mm-hmm.
I love Jeff Vandermeer, right? But it kind of gets old when you say, I read weird literature, and someone says, oh, have you read Annihilation?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, I've read that book that got it made into a Netflix movie. again, which is not a problem, not a knock on Vandermeer. I'm looking forward to authority very much. But there are other voices out there doing really interesting things. And you actually pitched one of those authors, which I haven't, I didn't hear about her before. Reading her book for this episode. We are going to be talking about Karen Ann Hui Lee's Love Chronicles of the Octopods. I don't know how you want to pronounce that. Which was released in, I have like my physical copy of the book. Where was it released? 2023, so it's quite recent as well. Funnily enough, I'm not convinced this book exists. It's not on her Wikipedia entry or on her website. And it is a weird book. But a few words about Lee. By the way, she got her MFA at Brown University, which you share with her. And I now live in Providence, and it's one of the things that we first connected over. So that was fun to see. And she's like a well-celebrated author, mostly of poetry. She's won several awards, and her poetry has appeared in all of the right places. But again, I've never heard of this book, and it doesn't appear anywhere on official sources online, so maybe it doesn't exist. Do you want to walk us through the premise before we dive into the themes and like dig deeper?
I mean, one thing I just want to say before diving into that is also how hard it was to get the book.
Oh yeah.
my local quote unquote indie bookstore, which I will not besmirch the name of, though I'm really frustrated with it. Like, why can't you get a indie press book at a indie bookstore? It's just crazy to me. I called to I like got in a fight with a person. I was like, listen, you, where else are you supposed to get books? Jesus.
Yeah.
You,
yeah. This is what the bookstore is for. Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. There's something to be said about. So I found the Book of Webs. Well, Ronnie, my wife, found the Book of Webs at the Harvard bookstore, the good one. Mm-hmm. Those two ones, right? The evil one and the good one.
Mm-hmm.
At the good one, and the only reason we picked it up was I think the cover like spoke to her in some sort of way, and then I read the synopsis and I was like, okay, I need to read this. But it's become harder and harder to find these things, I think, on bookshelves because they're being squeezed out by, again, not to knock on the person herself, but like the 20th Mass fantasy novel, right? Or the 50th reprint of, okay, I'm going to say it. We don't need more Dune reprints.
Right? Yeah, yeah. And I'm not even talking about on the shelf. I actually called them and was like, can I special order this book? Because I had a gift card to use there. And they were like, unfortunately, we can't. That's not it.
What do you mean?
I can go on Amazon and like buy it there. Why can't you figure out how to get a copy of this book in your bookstore? It's just crazy.
Literally what you do is procure books.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but you did get a copy, so
I did. Yeah,
I really enjoyed my read of it. So walk us through what happens. Well, if anything, on Love Chronicles.
I mean, it's very it's I think a kind of like masterfully static book. I think I've seen it. You know, I think one of the blurbs compares it to David Markson, and I think that's accurate. But even less so than like Wittgenstein's Mistress, I would say, but some of his other works that are very just like a voice speaking. Mm-hmm. As far as the narrator's understanding of things, I think, a clone of Emily Dickinson that, due to some kind of mishap in the genetics, came out as an octopus, has been exiled from the Genzopolis to the far side of the universe, where she is entirely alone, but still kind of brimming with language. And the language that comes out is, I think, what this book is.
Yeah, the synopsis calls her bubbling, I think.
Mm.
Like she bubbles over with language. It seems like that she can't stop talking, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's almost like a graphomaniac sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And static is a very good adjective for it, right? Like it's like the Seinfeld joke, right? It's about nothing. It's a show about nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing happens in this book, but through Emily D, that's how she calls herself, through Emily D's narrative, you kind of get to know the weird, like seriously weird universe that she occupies. And like you do learn sketches of what's going on. Genetics is like a big thing, and there's been like a lot, it's in the far future, right? There have been a lot of genetics and bioengineering sort of a thing that everybody can do, including the protagonist. And also on a massive scale, and yet what she spends her time in this hyper futuristic society doing is having cocktails, basically, right? And writing to herself. I wanted to ask you about like graphomaniac tendencies and not being able to write. I saw the Book of Webs gets compared a lot to Philip K. Dick. And Philip K. Dick was famously not diagnosed, but he pretty obviously suffered from the actual mental condition called graphomania, especially when he was writing The Exegesis, where he couldn't stop writing, right? The Exegesis, the unedited version of The Exegesis, has like 8,000 pages or something like that. Did you feel that when you were working on the Book of Webs, like some sort of unstoppable capacity of the writing? Because parts of it do come off as like, you know, gushing out.
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's also like really timely right now because I've been really struggling with like the next book. And there's been I feel like there's like an on and off valve in me that I do not understand or have any control over.
Interesting.
That, yeah, it's either like, it is kind of an unstoppable gush or like a total trickle. Yeah, the Book of Webs was written a lot in conversation with writer's block, I would say. A lot of passages I wrote in it began as like, today I can't write because X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm. So do you see that same like tendency in Love Chronicles? Because I definitely do, like the author working through something by just keeping on writing.
Yeah, I think that's part of that bubbling. It's like, what's the, like, in one sentence there will be a kind of like almost like underwater, like a little fizzle of something, and in the next sentence that becomes like a full-scale bubble, and it's often really odd things. It's like a hard book to follow the sequence of events, because it's sometimes a very like not what my mind would choose to be like, this is the interesting part of the sentence, to like expand into a full bubble.
So a lot of sidetracking, right?
And like weird things that are a metaphor in one sentence will become kind of not a metaphor in the next. But then they just pop like a bubble, and you're like back to the thing that they had been a metaphor for, and discussing that instead of like the thing that they're no longer a metaphor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you if you're talking about Love Chronicles or Book of Webs, but I think the answer is yes. I think both books do that. Interesting to me, I've spoken a lot on this podcast about like the absolute tension between contradiction between how art actually is usually made and how consumers of the art imagine it being made. And writing is one of those where people imagine the writer is like Monskier kind of like figure stuck in a dark tower and lightning hits them on the head and divine inspiration makes them write a book, where in fact a book is written by many people. Right. And the author is often just a focal point for conversations and happenstance and chance encounters and so on. But in Love Chronicles, the character is isolated. Right. And she does write a bit like Emily Dickinson in that way, right? Or something very Victorian, right? About her sensibilities, but also how she sees why she writes. Whereas the Book of Webs, I found the comparison interesting. Is there more than one character? Or is there one character with a multiplicity of faces and personalities and so on? So talk to me a bit about how you see that writing experience, like aloneness versus talking to others, when that helps, when that doesn't, and what you think about Love Chronicles being like a solitary work, right, with one character in the narrative.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I was writing a lot thinking about like Bakhtin's dialogicality. I took a really influential class with Timothy Buse at Brown on this. So I want to cite him there as having a huge influence on how I was thinking about this isolation versus conversation kind of thing. And I think one of his takes on one of the ways that has really influenced me, what Buse had to say about it, is like that pretty much as soon as there's any language, there's dialogicality. Like even a monologue is a dialogue in disguise, because, you know, I think part of the points he was making, he was looking at books that were often almost like entirely solitary, solipsistic experiments in this way. And if you look, you know, I think Bakhtin made this point as well, through reading like Dostoevsky's, when Raskolnikov is totally by himself, his conversations are, they're conversations. They're not monologues. It's not like, now I am thinking about this. Next, I will think about that. Like, that's not how thoughts work. They're paying attention to my own head, which is a mess. It's like there's so many voices there. And I only say things in my stream of consciousness or whatever, because someone else is saying something else to me. So I don't think Love Chronicles is an exception to that. Like, I had the sense of a lot of kind of isolation in it, for sure. And there is something peculiar about it, but I also, don't see the work as existing in a head that is not comprised of dialogue.
We can even do a lingual analysis, you know, the sentence, I'm talking to myself, has two subjects, right? Does dialogue though, when you talk to yourself? Not to continue name dropping, you know, but it's like Fichte had this idea, right, of two eyes, right? The eye that is observing the ego, right? So there's always two people when you look at yourself. There's the self that's being observed and the self that's doing the observation. And when you write, or at least some works, when they write, like they're focused on this internality and this dialogue. And I think Love Chronicles actually does a really good job of it, because it challenges the reader to ask, how much of what Emily D is telling us is self-propaganda, right? Like things that she tells herself to feel good about herself, and how many things are quote-unquote real, right, or accurate. How much of this is like edited? Because she would like to pretend that she's completely completely honest, right? Mm-hmm. Like entirely truth-telling and so on. But there are many parts of the book which tell us that actually her views are pretty radical, right? When it comes to her society and how things are portrayed. So I also found that very interesting. It's also a very interesting way to be introduced to a world through a dissident.
Yeah.
Right? For someone who stands aside from that world and is even in exile in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? Rogue,
yeah. And that, that almost gives you a perspective that you can't get from someone who is in the hegemony of a society.
Yeah. Yeah, but there is a really interesting kind of like, I mean, there's lots of hints that like, this is not, she's not as isolated or as far away from society as she says she is.
Yeah.
Like there's the moon. The moon is really important. And granted, it could be a different moon, could be a different sun, that the moon is, that the moonlight is reflecting. But I feel like there is kind of this self consciousness in the novel that is like, is any of this true? I was thinking a lot about who the addressee of this is throughout. I don't know, as someone who's been close to poetry circles a lot, but never in them, and who doesn't read a lot of poetry, like, there was some times where I felt a kind of like breaking of the fourth wall and a sense that the addressee here is like a poetic community, which I don't know is an interesting way to go. It was in this conversation.
I think poetry is like, I mean, it's always relevant when you read Lee's work, because she is primarily a poet, right? Mm-hmm. And a critic of poetry as well. And this book is definitely something we would describe as poetic, I think. Mm-hmm. And Langdon and I, when we do this podcast, we talk a lot about you know, the tension between prose and poetics and what exactly are poetics, right? I think it's a, rightfully so, a very hard thing to describe. Mm-hmm. But I think that relationship with like the content of the book is as much in word choices and structure as it is in the content of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
A big part of what is poetic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that's a very valid point, I think, for Book of Webs as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
You could try to read Book of Webs as, you know, a plot, but you're going to have a bad time, I think, right? a lot of it is, you know, meaning and words, you know, being adjacent to each other in ways that make you rethink your understanding of certain concepts. And I think for this book, and like to go back to what you said about the who's this been written for, from a technical perspective, I think what this book does really well is that I felt like it's almost being written to me in many ways.
Yeah.
Like I actually felt that Emily D is like chatting with me, right?
Yeah.
I could imagine myself in like a saloon with her and she's just babbling,
mm-hmm,
while I'm like nodding along and hemming and hawing, and she just like keeps going because she can't stop. Mm-hmm. To be very clear, like something I want to make clear to the readers, like to the listener, sorry, she's a very likable character.
Mm-hmm.
She's charming, I think, in a lot of ways. I don't know, in a bit of a condescending way. She's, mm-hmm, very childish in a lot of the book. But she still, I don't know, I liked her by the time I was done.
Mm-hmm.
She's like a very fresh voice, right?
Yeah, she's funny. She's like, her descriptions of things are spectacularly gorgeous and evocative, yeah, and like delicious, like the food in it. It's just like, yeah.
Yeah, and in that way, you know, I was thinking a lot about, is this a magical realist book?
Hmm.
And I think the richness of the language is often like a cipher for magical realism.
Mm.
You know, no metaphor is prosaic. No metaphor is common. Everything is like very scintillating and very picturesque. And it's certainly true for this book. Also, the moon being like a personified thing and the lover of the character is a very magical realist thing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see any magical realism in this? Is magical realism something that you're interested in, by the way? Because I think like certain segments of Book of Webs could also be cataloged as such.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious about, I feel like I don't have, you know, a strong like generic definition for magical realism. I kind of, you know, I love Marquez. I love reading, you know, the classic magical realism stuff, but I'm not exactly sure how you would define the difference between like magical realism and say science fiction, which I feel like the book is more categorized as.
Yeah, I think we could have like a whole episode just on that question. It's a very interesting one. I feel like there's something about, and you can see it in this book, actually. It's actually a good example to have this discussion, right? Like some aspects of the book situate objects, right? Create actual objects in the existence of the narrative, if that makes sense, right? Like
mm-hmm.
What's the city called? It has like a weird name.
Genzopolis, I think.
Genzopolis, exactly. Yeah. I was gonna say Gentopia, but Genzopolis. It's like in the narrative of the book, it's a place, it's an entity, it has rules. We can explore its systems, right, and how it works. Mm-hmm. And the book does that in many ways. Like it talks about its social mores and its ethics and taboos and desires and so on. Whereas magic realism takes things which are common to us and infuses them with some sort of extra meaning or imagery, right? Mm-hmm. Like taking the moon and making it into a personified lover.
Mm-hmm.
Or like Borges taking a marketplace pendant, right, that you might buy from like a, you know, like a grandmother selling trinkets at a marketplace and discovering that it's like a relic and completely captures your obsession and perspective. Mm-hmm. So it's like the normal made magical, whereas science fiction describes a different normal. Mm-hmm. If you pressed me up against the wall and forced me to define it, that's what I would say.
Yeah, I feel like given that definition, this does feel more science fictional to me.
Yeah.
Other than the fact that, you know, I feel like there is no transparency into the world that we're in. Like, it is all mediated through Emily D. And often not only mediated as an unreliable narrator, but also through these really extended passages that have been explicitly called fantasies or imaginations or like tangents that we know are not actually happening, like the apocalyptic scene, which is which I don't think is recounting anything. It's just kind of like a fantasy.
It's interesting, like the tension between, so there's like nothing in this book, because it's far future, actually exists, right? It doesn't pretend to communicate with our reality, right? Which some science fiction does try to do, right? It does try to say things about how things really are. This is like a complete flight of fancy, right? And yet there are different levels of fancy in the book. Right? There are things which are immediate, like what Emily D is drinking or thinking about or eating, or the many actions that she performs, right? It's like the gene editing and so on.
Yeah.
But then there are things that she says almost as if they were a rumor, right? From her perspective. Like the apocalyptic story that you mentioned, or like things that are happening in this utopian, dystopian city that she describes, or what other people are doing and so on.
Yeah.
Right. So
like the moon, which comes down as a, you know, as a messenger, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that like her imagination, or is it actually happening? But also, I think a deeper question is like, why does that matter? Right? What does it tell us if the moon is actually communicating with her versus her invention?
Yeah, especially because the frame itself has no communication with our reality or something like that.
Wait, expand on that. That's interesting.
I'm trying to kind of articulate a point I think you were making of like, given that this is a work of fiction that is not in communication, you know, not saying like this is a real story, or this is, or even in science fiction terms, like, and this is speculative. I mean, there are speculative elements for sure, but I think part of what's so fun about this book and so wonderful about its premise is it's like bonkers. Like, okay, like if we get to a point where we're doing all this gene editing stuff, like how would a clone accidentally end up as an octopus, like a clone of Emily Dickinson? Like, so in that sense, like, we're already so far detached from kind of like if we're thinking of a book as like an extended metaphor of our reality or something like that, like this one already feels it already feels so far removed that it's interesting that within that isolated space, there's still these levels of unreality that when I was reading them, I did struggle with being like, all right, come on, get us back to like the real part. Like, we've been in this extended metaphor for so long, and I'm ready to like know if like Emily's going to fit her entire body into the pickle jar. The olive jar, rather.
I have to call you out here a bit, right? Because I was feeling that when I was reading Book of Webs. Right, like this aside about presidential assassination, when can we get back to the cave where a surgeon is taking out your eyes? But it's interesting. No, I'm not saying this is like to blame you or anything, but it's interesting the differences between when we write and when we read, right? Like what tolerances we have for things that we read in others versus what we ourselves end up making.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think a lot about, you know, one of the funny things is people keep recommending me podcasts, but I don't like podcasts. even though I make one, I just I don't like them. I don't like listening to them, mostly because I really like music, and music will always take precedence. So when I have time to listen, I just listen to music instead. But also because I just don't like podcasts, which is funny because I make one. I bet some people listen to this podcast and they're like, Eden, what the hell are you talking about? Can we get to the stuff that we actually want to talk about? but there was one more thing that caught my ear that you mentioned. You know, it's interesting going back to the question of the weird, right? And accepted forms of weird. There's this idea that the weird, in order to be truly weird, it has to do, or I'll say it differently. Most of the weird that we encounter today, the popular one, is evokes this idea that Freud called unheimlich, right? The home, unhomely home, right? Unfamiliar home, where something that you thought was familiar turns out to be strange, right? Like think about aliens, right? Like they're tall or very short. They look like people, but they're not people, right? Or Ex Machina, right? The movie, or some of Vandermeer's work, right? How can these normal things suddenly shift and change? But that's not the only type of weird there is out there, right? And for a long period of time in literature, that wasn't how you got to weird. Weird, for example, in the 70s and the 80s, was strange, messed up creatures that bear no resemblance to humans. Right, and Delaney and Asimov and Philip Jose Farmer and all these guys were in this arms race who could invent a more messed up dude, basically, right? Like, and a more inventive world that has nothing to do with our own. And the more distant it was, the more science fiction it was, right? And the weirder that it was. And then sometime, maybe in the 90s or even a bit later, like it became this, no, show me things that I'm used to seeing, but mess them up in a way, right? And I feel like Love Chronicles is, for its inventiveness, I was going to say because of its inventiveness, but also through its inventiveness, kind of digs back into this, no, science fiction should be wild, right? It should be beyond your imagination. It should be very exaggerated. And it's weird because it's so... it takes for granted so many things that are unsettling to us and different from what we know. And that's kind of a psychological exercise, isn't it? Like, look at what I can believe in. Right? Or, look at what I can convince you that I believe in. Which is interesting because, again, in the context of the Book of Webs, right? Like, the Book of Webs is a religion or like a... not a cult, but an organization of people who have a shared belief, which is what to defeat MFA committees, right?
Among other things.
So do you feel like, is this resonating with you, like this idea to like believe and convince the reader that you believe in these outlandish things? Is that like one of the skills that you see yourself employing as a writer?
I think one place I'd go with that is believing as like almost an ethics, I think feels like a place that feels really resonant between
a practice, a habit, you mean?
No, an ethics, like it's ethical. To that it's not like to believe in Emily D's reality feels like an ethical imperative. Even if it's outlandish, it's like, I think you're a bad person if you don't.
Okay, why? Well, I agree with you. I mean, I agree with you out of instinct, right? Because I like Emily D, but so that thought process.
I'm thinking about, I guess, difficulty. Like, I know that I wrote a really difficult book, and I think this book is difficult too. And this also gets into like our original conversation about books that are kind of hard to find and are not part of the weird canon that's, you know, under the rock that's under the rock that we all live under. So like I think Emily D is an exile from Genzopolis for having genes that are not designed. She was a designed being, mm-hmm. but within that design, her genes got fucked up. Now she's a rogue, genetic rogue. She cannot be like tolerated in the Genzopolis, which like let's think of as the place where those of us fortunate enough to have been designed in such a way that we are consistent with the logic of the Genzopolis, we get to stay. So she's been exiled. I think to engage with like a book that's weird in a different way than weird fiction tends to be is also to like be looking at something that's like exiled in this way from the culture within which like our books are designed to fit. And I think to be like weird to weird fiction is to be like doubly exiled in this way.
Hmm.
So then to get back to why it's an ethical imperative to believe in Emily D is like, this is a new, wonderfully strange being in the world, whether it's, you know, quote unquote fictional or not. It's like, there's not a voice like this that I've heard babbling like this. And now that this book exists, we can like listen to it. And through that listening, something new is introduced into the Genzopolis, I guess.
Mm. Very interesting. It's almost like Ursula Le Guin's empathy as ethics, right? Mm. Like listening and giving others space within not just in quote unquote real space, but also inside of us, right? Letting mm-hmm. this voice speak into your head. Like mm-hmm. when you're reading a book, you're letting someone speak into your head. Going back to that mm-hmm. point we made about dialogue, and sometimes they can put things that are not that nice there, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's a certain level of trust, right? That they're doing it. I don't know if in your favor, your enjoyment, your edification. But here you're saying it's almost like listening to Emily D and giving her space is, you know, making us better at listening to people who are weird and on the periphery and different, even if they're babbling, right? Even if they're going on and on and on, they still have something to say. And we would all do, you know, we would all be better if we were patient with them.
And yeah, I mean, I would even go a little farther and say that books are not so much like teach us how to be empathetic with each other, but even that a book like this or my intention with the Book of Webs, I would say if I had any, is like, yeah, my intention, why I call myself like the non-fictional representative of this book is that I feel like the voices that that I encountered through the writing of that book were not unreal. They were not, I mean, it was ethics to believe in them, because these were voices that had no space in the Genzopolis, what I'm calling the Genzopolis, like the
yeah
the world that
the multiplicity of all the people and opinions out there, right?
Yeah, it's the like the whole all of the language. All of the language. Yeah. And then there was these voices that would mostly, you know, most of the voices I encountered were through dreams, where those who have no space in my real life, I feel like are finally have a chance when I'm fucking relaxed finally to say their shit. And so then to listen to them and to believe in them is to bring persons into, if a person, you know, what's the etymology of person is something like through sound, something like that.
Yeah.
Like if a person is the kind of like, let's call it like a vector of communication or something, or side of communication. Like these are real persons. I think the voices that exist within books. And so to read a book that other people aren't reading, I think is to, I think has potential to allow new people into our society, like entirely new people, not necessarily to be a good tool for communicating with others, but rather like a way of creating a society that's larger and more inclusive of really different kinds of persons.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I think it brings me back to Vandermeer, right? Which I think when he's at his best, I think the absolute best thing that Vandermeer ever wrote were the chapters of Dead Astronauts that are from the perspective of a fox. And he, especially near the end, it becomes almost unintelligible or hard to understand for humans. And he's kind of doing what you're saying, right? Like, there are animal ways to be, right? And animal persons out there with their own perspectives about life. And of course, I can't think like a fox, right? But I can try to leave space for this, what I imagine this different perspective might sound like. And the exercise of trying to speak like another person, like a different person, is useful and meaningful and correct in its own right, right? Because it's almost a muscle to think about things differently, to try and experience them as a different person might. And isn't that like the basic definition of empathy, right? Being able to see things from another person's perspective. And it's easy to do when the other person is like us, but hard to do when that other person is very different to us. Something that we all need to get better at. I wanted to ask you if the Dream Hotline is still open and is it still like operated?
Oh, I'm so glad we get to plug the Dream Hotline.
Yeah.
My fiance is going to be so happy because that's a project we've done together.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Wait, so tell the listeners about the Dream Hotline.
Okay. The Dream Hotline is a phone number that you can call or text, where you're invited to tell us your dreams. The phone number is, I forget the actual number, but it's dreaming. We were trying to find the right amount of numbers, you know.
I have it open. It's 843-732-6464.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it still exists, right? You can still...
It like, still exists, yeah. We were putting up posters for a while, and we were getting more calls. We haven't gotten a call for a very long time, except from Sam, my fiance's mom, who has awesome dreams, and sometimes will leave us some. but for a while, we were really getting quite a number of people who, I guess, have seen our little ads we would put up on, post up on out in public.
I had an ulterior motive to bring up the Dream Hotline because it lets me tell you something that I wanted to tell you ever since we said we would do an episode together. 1 week after I finished the Book of Webs, I was walking around in Providence and I saw a sign, you know, where the bottom is cut out into like little piece of paper you can tear off with a phone number. It said, "Lost something, looking for something, call us, lost and found." it was 1 week after I'd finished the Book of Webs. And I was like, what's going on? And the idea that I had is that it's Providence itself, like, leaving up these ads. I love this town. I really like it here. I don't like the whole, like, you know, I don't like Lovecraft. Okay, let's just put that out there. So the whole, like, when someone says Providence should be weird, what they're thinking about is like Lovecraft stories. But when I think about like the weirdness of Providence, is like, there's been so many weird people here, right? Because of the university and because of a bunch of other stuff. I just like walking around and imagining those people, you know, in the spaces that I currently inhabit. And then that message that I haven't called the number yet, but I'm going to at some point. I don't know. I was like, I need to tell Jesse about this. I needed to tell you about this experience.
Yeah. One thing that just popped into my head when you said the weird people wandering around Providence. I was pretty depressed when I was there. I was going through a really hard time for a lot of my MFA. One thing I found that helped, I did a lot of walking because, you know, you can't park anywhere around the university. I lived close enough to walk. So I would walk to school or go for walks in various parks and stuff. I would do a lot of walking, and I found that it was really helpful if I pretended to smile. So there's definitely a couple of years where Providence was peopled by this very strange, hairy little man, just like smiling, walking around the streets. That was me.
Thank you so much for coming on, Jesse. This was such a pleasure. If you'd be open to it, we can do this again sometime in the future.
Yeah, I'd love to. This was great.
And pick a different weird book. Mm. We usually end episodes with a piece of music. And this time around, I am going to play something from one of my favorite contemporary bands, Twerp, otherwise known as TWRP. These guys do like disco, new funk. But here's the thing. They're always in costume, and all the costumes are like Wizard of Oz influenced, like the Tin Man and the Lion and so on. But in like the far future, as someone in the 70s would imagine it, they just released an album called Digital Nightmare. And it sounds exactly as you would imagine that it sounds. I'm going to play Online, which is the fourth or the fifth track from it. And it's just fun. It's just happy, and it's bubbling, right? And I think Emily D would like this song, which is why I chose it. Again, Jesse, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Eden.
Yeah, and this is TWRP with Online. Hey, baby, I try to meet your eye, but those eyes weren't made for me. I ask around, cause the night has just begun. Mystery. Such a mystery. Such a mystery. Cool glasses, I look at my lot, and your binary earrings are getting me hot. There is a certain time and place for love, and I'm starting to think that I know what you want. I think I know what you like, so farewell and goodbye. You can catch me later, baby. Crazy, loving you all day on my display.
Oh baby, when I pass you by, I'm just another guy asking myself, why do I try?
Boy, why are we so poor out here in reality when we've both done virtually?
Stop feeling myself, you make me feel 20 feet tall here in our world. Never knew that I could feel this way. Never knew.